ladies and gentlemen, please welcome Sylvia Panetta.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to the Monterey Conference Center for the final event of the 15th anniversary season of the Panetta Institute Lecture Series, 15 years. As you know, this year we've been discussing the revolutionary changes that have affected our nation in this new century and have been reflecting on what these transformations mean for our democracy and for the future. We've discussed the Arab Spring in the Middle East and the hope for peace and democratic reforms in the wake of so much turmoil. We heard from Alan Simpson and Robert Reich on the long and the short perspectives on economic changes that impact our future. And we looked for inspiration from our founders and past presidents as we witnessed the changes in the role of the presidency as the electorate prepares to decide again who should lead our nation. Throughout each of these discussions, there has been a common element that has touched each topic. From the uprisings in the Middle East to the crisis in the global economy to the ability of presidents and candidates to communicate, the way we live our lives has been transformed because of new technology called the Internet. When we launched this lecture series 15 years ago, would we have imagined that people could watch archived versions of our programs on their phones? Or that a firm would launch a multi-billion dollar IPO based on electronic friendships and funny photographs? Would we have been able to foresee that this technology would become the primary means for young revolutionaries to communicate with one another and the outside world? The Internet drives the hottest stocks on Wall Street, shapes technological innovation, and grabs the hottest sound bites. It has had tremendous impact on society. It has had tremendous impact on government. It has had tremendous impact on commerce. And it has had tremendous impact on other institutions and has changed the way we live, the way we work, the way we learn, the way we profit, the way we govern, and the way we communicate. But in the wake of such progress, are we prepared for the unintended consequences that have come with the dizzying speed of information? From the threat of a cyber attack, to privacy concerns, to the growing dominance of companies like Google and Facebook, are individuals and our nation sufficiently protected? How are cell phones, BlackBerries and iPads changing the way we relate and understand each other? Tonight, we'll discuss the possibilities and the consequences of the Internet with three experts. Their combined insight touches on almost every aspect of this diverse subject, including technology, security, safety, politics, economics, communication, and culture. Our first guest is Vice President and Chief Internet Evangelist of Google and is widely known as one of the fathers of the Internet. He is the co-designer of the TCP/IP protocols and architecture of the Internet and was awarded the National Medal of Technology as well as the Presidential Medal of Freedom in recognition of his achievements. Please welcome Dr. Vinton Cerf. The second chair from the far end. Our second guest is President and Editor-in-Chief of AOL Huffington Post Media Group and founder of one of the most widely read, linked to, and frequently cited media brands on the Internet, the Huffington Post. An internationally syndicated columnist and the author of 13 books, she has recently written extensively on the development of the Internet and the need to include engagement, to include trust, and to include authenticity in new forms of media. Please welcome Arianna Huffington.
Thank
being here. Little chat. Our third guest is a journalist and internet safety advocate who has been following the development of the internet since its early inception. From 2010 to 2011, he served on the President's Online Safety and Technology Working Group, where he chaired the Education Subcommittee and wrote the education section of the group's report to Congress. Presently, he reports daily as technology analyst for CBS News and KCBS. Please welcome Dr. Larry Magid. Incidentally, before I forget, please remember, as we told you in your notice, that our program this evening runs until 9 p.m. It usually ends at 8:30, but we've got two full hours of these wonderful speakers. Leading the discussion is an experienced journalist and moderator who has been at the forefront of the study of new media and its impact on journalism. He is the founder of the Public Affairs Project at the Center for Innovative Media, where he's launching an election year project called Face the Facts USA. A former anchor, White House correspondent, and interview host with CNN, he now serves as director of the School of Media and Public Affairs at the George Washington University. Please welcome back Frank Cesno. Thank you.
Take your place. Okay. How are you? Good to see you. Well, thank you very, very much. I am delighted to be back here in beautiful Monterey to conclude this year's wonderful series focusing on revolutions of the 21st century. The internet and social media represent the most remarkable and transformative technologies we can imagine, certainly since the creation of the automobile, the telephone, the light bulb, the newspaper, just about anything we can imagine. In just a few short years, it's become impossible to think of life without these technologies. They've become utilities in our lives. So what lies ahead? Where is this all taking us? Where might we end up? The mind races. I'm here with three guests who've studied this topic and committed this topic from just about every angle, from communication, journalism, diplomacy, security, safety, commerce, innovation, and on it goes. So we will get started, and it is great to see you all this evening.
It's a pleasure to be here.
I thought maybe we'd start with our audience. That's a good place to start with a conversation like that, and for those in the television audience or following us online, you can play this game at home too, a little audience participation. How many of you in the audience own and use a smartphone? Raise your hands.
Wow. So there.
How many own and use a smart tablet of some sort? Wow. How many of you get news, information, weather, the stocks online? Just about every. How many of you only don't do anything online, but you subscribe to newspapers, and that's how you live? Okay, there are a few endangered species.
Some people are
proud endangered species. I want to start the conversation, the subject of this, revolutions of the 21st century. Is this a revolution or an evolution?
It's both. Any revolution that you know anything about starts in a way that might be small. Getting that first airplane off the ground by the Wright brothers was not the same as flying a jet at 50,000 feet. Internet is a revolution. It took a technology called packet switching, which was considered crazy at the time by the traditional telecom people, and made it work for computers. There could not have been a better choice. But it has evolved over the past 40 years since that first idea was put on
paper. But you see this as revolutionary.
I see a revolution that has to evolve, and that means that it starts as a revolution and then it becomes an evolution.
And what makes it, in your mind, revolutionary?
It's revolutionary because the previous communication technologies would not have served to allow computers to freely interact with each other at the scale and the speed that they do today on the internet, and even did in the beginning.
Ariana?
It is unquestionably a revolution. First of all, because it has given voice to millions, and it's soon going to be billions, of people who otherwise would not have had a voice. And that has revolutionary implications for everything, for politics, for the way we live our lives, for good and for evil. You know, for good in that it's like saying we have all these amazing minds, potentially, who otherwise would not have had a seat at the table. And now, if you think of the fact that 3 billion additional people are going to have smartphones or some connection to the internet between now and 2020, all these people, all these billions of people, the rising billions, as they call them, are going to have a seat at the table, potentially adding, contributing to everything that we know about life and everything that we want to contribute to life, as well as everything we may want to avoid about life.
Larry, maybe it's revolutionary because before I came out here, I tweeted this event, yes, and I now just live in a 140-character world, and I don't even I don't even need to conjugate a verb anymore.
What I think is revolutionary about it is when I think back to the Gutenberg Bible, what Gutenberg accomplished is he made it possible for the common person to read what the priests and the pundits and the gurus had to say. What the internet makes possible is for everyone to contribute to that conversation, more or less what Ariana had been saying, so that finally, after the 20th century, because really Gutenberg, if you look at radio, television, newspapers, magazines, they were all pretty much the same model that Gutenberg started. But today we have the model where you don't have to be a priest to have a voice. And that is a revolutionary change in really the whole history of humanity.
But some might say, yeah, that's true. But when I ask about evolution, it's just we're just moving everything faster. There was a printing press, there was a telegraph, there was a radio, there was a television.
Dead wrong. The reason that's dead wrong is that what this system does is facilitate group interaction, discovery of people who that you don't know that have common interests. You don't even have to know who they are in order to interact with them online. This is a very different kind of collaborative environment that we didn't have in any of the other mass media.
All a good thing, Ariana?
No.
Well,
in a word.
Sorry, I didn't mean to put anything in there.
No, definitely not all a good thing. The way I see it is that it is this amazing new chapter in our history.
In human history.
In human history. If you think of it, it's as Adam told Eve in the Garden of Eden. I was there, I know that.
But he didn't tweet this.
That's how old I am. He said, he said, "We're darling, we're living in a time of transition." And and I think we can say that again. Darlings, we're living in a time of transition. And we are living in a kind of Garden of Eden. I mean, the internet has made an enormous amount possible. But there are snakes, not just one, but I have identified two snakes in that internet Garden of Eden. And I think it is terribly important that we pay attention to the snakes before they grow so big and overwhelm us. And I would say the first snake is that there are dangers to hyperconnectivity.
Hyperconnectivity.
The fact that we are connected now, practically 24/7. I mean, it's hard. I have two daughters. One of them graduated from college. The other is going to be a junior in college. It's very hard for me to convince them not to sleep with their smartphones, you know, not to sleep with their iPhones. You know, it's becoming kind of more dangerous than to sleep with guys.
That's less dangerous. How about people who cross the street slowly as they're texting?
Against the law in one town in New Jersey now. There's actually a town that's going to be giving people tickets for texting while walking.
Texting while okay. Yeah. Never mind, driving. Okay, so one snake. Let's finish the snakes.
So that's
snake one is
snake.
Hyperconnectivity.
You talk about the dangers of
snake
hyperconnectivity.
Two.
Snake two is what I call the fetishization of virality. You know, we kind of fetishize something going viral, or something trending on Twitter. Something is trending on Twitter, or something is going viral. Can we please stop for a minute and ask whether it's worthwhile, whether it should be going viral, whether it should be trending on Twitter, whether we care? You know, it's really an extension of what TV has been doing with the breaking news that's not breaking news. You know about that a lot.
I have no idea what you're talking about.
But like,
it's breaking wind.
Yeah, it's breaking. It often is. You know, I watch TV kind of on mute while I'm working in my office. And, you know, the other day, I remember I look up breaking news. Okay, pay attention. Donald Trump to endorse Mitt Romney. Really? Is that really breaking news? It's barely news, you know? It's like if he was endorsing Obama, it might be news. But so,
Frank, so there's something really delicious about the analogies that you're using. We got the Garden of Eden, right? So I think the engineers are Adam. And then along comes this woman with this apple. And I don't know, there's this company that... No, we don't want to go there.
There's a bite out of the apple, too.
It's when the general public gets into the use of the internet that we go from Eden to something else, because the general public is, you know, the full range of human incentive and interest and everything else, some of which are inimical to society.
Larry, I want to ask you about fetishes for a minute, if I can.
Okay. My wife's in the audience, so be careful here.
Ariana was talking about the sort of fetishizing of this whole viral thing. Yeah. You got to go viral. And then we ask later whether there's any value to it.
Yeah.
What's your take on that? Because it's a fascinating idea. I mean, this is trending, and follow this and follow that, and my Twitter stream is pouring this stuff forth, and I'm lost.
We all watch Paris Hilton and Lindsay Lohan, you know, become major celebrities for God knows why. And now we can all be major celebrities in theory, that anybody can create a YouTube video and make a fool out of themselves, or tweet something stupid, or post something, and there is the possibility, it probably won't happen, but there's a possibility that millions of people may see it. And I agree with Ariana. We have a term in the computer industry, garbage in, garbage out. And there's a lot of garbage that's going to be published in this environment. And the key thing is for individuals to have the critical thinking to know what's important and what isn't, and to have the filters to only pay attention to what is likely to be important and relevant, while at the same time not having such fine filters that you block out all diversity of opinion. And so that's kind of the balance that we all play, that the tightrope we walk. I want to know about what's important, but I don't want to know just about the echo chamber that I live in. But I do think that the internet makes it possible for lots of people, and you know, there are far more than two snakes. There's all sorts of criminals who go on the internet, whether it's for economic crime, or whether to harass people, or whether to enter into relationships with people that they might not want to be entered into. There's all sorts of stuff out there on the internet.
You worry about our safety and security.
Well, I don't worry about it, but I do run a nonprofit called Connect Safely that helps parents understand internet safety. But the fundamental issue is that we see the glass as mostly full, it's a little bit empty. We worry about bullying, but we also point out that the vast majority of kids don't bully. We worry about predators, but we point out that it's a very, very small percentage of people who are affected by that. So it's not so much worry as it is just as when you walk down the streets of Cannery Row, exercise a certain amount of street smarts in order to protect yourself.
Ariana, you raised the value proposition, sort of, what is this worth for us? And I think of tweets that told us that Osama bin Laden was killed. And I think of blogs that revealed that Dan Rather's expose on George W. Bush was wrong, was flawed. And I think of the access that people have had that gave rise to Tahrir Square that toppled a government. This is a kind of empowerment that we have not had in human history before.
Right, and I would say that at the very moment when our political system has become so dysfunctional, when we are polarized and paralyzed, in a way, what is coming in terms of people's self-expression, participation, engagement, is the one hope we have. It's the one countervailing power that we have. At the moment when super PACs can influence elections, when we have this incredible power to really drive an entire economy and country where certain special interests won, what is the only way that we can counter that? It's really through the fact that millions of people are engaged, involved, participating, and they actually have the ability now to be heard, which before belonged to people who owned printing presses or people who hired people who could contribute to whatever made their business successful.
Bindenserf, when you got into this.
Just a question.
Oh, sure.
Do you think that the PIPA and SOPA reaction online is another kind of example of being heard effectively?
Absolutely. Actually, I shouldn't say we, but the internet community that was very involved in that turned Congress around and even got the sponsor. These were the SOPA, online piracy
acts. Stop online piracy.
That would have basically criminalized and allowed the government to shut down certain websites that were accused of hosting pirated copy material. The people who were against that got Congress people who sponsored the bill to actually come out against the bill. It was an enormous, in fact, Google played a role in that, as did Wikipedia, but millions of people signed an online petition, and I know Congress people who are absolutely flabbergasted by the response that happened as a result of that campaign.
Let me ask you this, Bindenserf. Could you ever, in your wildest imagination, have imagined that we would end up here with instant communication around the world, able to communicate with someone in New Zealand, for example, free, instantly?
Of course.
When you started this?
This whole thing is unfolding exactly the way we planned it.
So we have you to blame after all.
In a couple of hours?
Including the snakes.
First of all, it's wrong to say just no, because we really did appreciate how powerful this could be. And we did made a couple of decisions in the engineering design that were intended to give this thing future-proof life. One of them was to make sure that the net was not designed to do anything in particular. It was designed to move little bags of bits from point A to point B with some probability greater than zero. That's all we asked of the underlying system. And all the rest of the recovery and everything else was another layer on the protocol stack. So that was one thing we did. Since it doesn't do anything in particular, it does everything. Not everything perfectly, but it does a lot. The second thing we said was that these little packets, these bags of bits, didn't need to know how they were being transported, whether it was a satellite link, an optical fiber, a radio channel, mobile, or fixed. That meant that every new communication technology that was invented from 1973, when we did the design, to the present, could be swept into and absorbed by and used by the internet. Both of those two things were at the top of our heads, trying to make this thing as adaptive as possible. And I would say, we thought, we would publish the specs. Anyone who wanted to could build a piece of the internet, and if they could find somebody to connect to, then the system would grow organically. And I would say that's exactly what's happened.
That's really amazing. Ariana, I know that you have drawn the distinction between information, knowledge, wisdom, and how this system is connecting or not those things. Talk about that.
Actually, before I draw this distinction, a third century philosopher called Plotinus drew this distinction. He said that knowledge has three stages. He called them science, opinion, and illumination. Let's say science are facts, you know, data. We are now swimming in data. Like, we have information about everything instantaneously. We're also swimming in opinion. We have opinion on everything in real time. And what we are lacking is what Plotinus called illumination, what we can call wisdom. We are lacking wisdom. I mean, everybody has to agree on that. Whether you're Republicans, Democrats, Independents, don't care about politics, just looking around, you see leaders in every field who are very smart, with very high IQs, great degrees, and making terrible decisions every day, many times a day. I mean, you know, you look around and you look at Lehman Brothers and you think to yourself, you know, was anybody home?
Yeah, the wrong people were at home.
No, but these people were not stupid. And, you know, sometimes I think if it was Lehman Brothers and sisters, maybe they would still be around, but that's... But my point is that, you know, why are we making so many bad decisions at a critical time in history when we need wise leaders more than ever? And I really profoundly believe that people are disconnected from their own wisdom. And this hyperconnectivity, the fact that we are always on, means that we don't have any time to really connect with ourselves, where wisdom lies. I mean, if you read the story of any great innovator, including, you know, Walter Isaacson's book on Steve Jobs,
right,
you know, he talked a lot about the importance of solitude. He He talked a lot about those were the times when he came up with the most innovative ideas. It's not in the middle of a crowd that you ultimately create. And we now have a generation growing up incapable of solitude.
But it's not just a generation growing up. They're the first ones. You know, you see this. We see it. I've watched you. You're texting constantly through everything.
Right. But also, because the hard way I learned 4 years ago, when I fainted from exhaustion, I hit my head on my desk, I broke my cheekbone, got 4 stitches on my right eye, and it started me on this journey of, I mean, speaking as a recovering addict.
I want to put in a word for young people here. I think that we have a tendency to sell short our young people. It is true that they are tweeting and they are Facebooking and they are blogging and they're up creating content, absorbing content. But you know, everybody I know who teaches at a university will acknowledge that kids are smarter than they used to be. They're doing quite well. We are seeing amazing innovation. Things are changing. People may not be reading 600-page books the way they read 600-page books, but they are acquiring knowledge. And a certain amount of people are absorbing it. We're always going to have people who are going to misuse things, who are going to fail to be analytical, who are going to be reactive, who are going to watch, you know, whether it's MSNBC or Fox and get a knee-jerk reaction to whatever the presenter said. But we're also raising a generation that I think is actually brighter than the generation that I came from, and we're probably going to leave the world in better hands.
You don't worry about the attention span issue?
Of course I worry about a lot of things.
Multitasking issue? You don't worry about the ability to distinguish good information from bad information?
I worry about the fact there's a lot of bad information out there, but bad information has been out there for a long time. It's not as if journalists suddenly, you know, bloggers were the first ones to come out with inaccurate information. We saw that throughout history. In my lifetime, we've seen it many times. I mean, the financial crisis, where it was run by people a lot older than today's kids, a lot of bad information. So sure, I worry about it, but I also see the potential, and I see the fact that kids are quicker on their feet, and they're thinking, and they're responding, and they're doing well.
So I'm going to channel Henry Kissinger. I can't do his accent very well, so I won't do that. But I had lunch with him a year or two ago, and the subject of internet was on the table. And he was very unhappy with it. And the reason he was unhappy is that he thought people, especially young people, were too satisfied too quickly with small amounts of information. Now, you understand, this is a man who writes 700-page books, so he's interested in having people pay attention to all 700 pages. But there is an issue there, that the instant gratification, instant satisfaction when you do a Google search or something may actually work against this notion of critical thinking, willingness to go and find competing.
Do you worry that critical thinking may be an endangered species in this process?
I worry that we will not imbue young people and the rest of us with the consciousness of needing to think critically, because we are confronted with all this information, and we ourselves are the only ones that can filter that out.
And we need it more than ever because of the diversity of information, because we've got so much coming at us. We have to have critical thinking. That is probably the most important thing that colleges and high schools and elementary schools and parents could be teaching young people, is to not take any one person's word for it, to check multiple sources, all the things that Frank and I have been trained to do with journalists, and beyond that, to realize that just because it's on the internet, not only does it mean it's true, but specifically means you've got to dig deeper.
Let me go back to the audience for a minute and ask another couple of questions. And again, if you're playing this game from home, you can do this too. But so for those in the audience, how many of you go to Google at least once a day?
Wow, thank you.
How many of you go to Google at least 5 times a day? How many Google something more than 5 times a day? Okay, are you ever sitting there and you're trying to remember a friend's last book or whatever and you check that at Google? So there was a famous piece, I think it was in the Atlantic Monthly, that said, Google making us stupid?
Yeah, oh yes, I remember
right?
that one.
Sorry, guys. I'm not making any accusations here. But the issue really was, are we becoming too reliant on this tool? Does it affect our memory? Is this our first refuge?
I don't really think that's a problem. I think the problem is when we take a tool and we make it a master. I think while Google and the internet are a tool, there's not a problem at all. We need to learn to disconnect. I mean, let us take something very, very simple, and you may think trivial, but extremely important, and that's sleep. A lot of people sleep. is actually affected by the fact that they go to bed with their devices. They keep them charging by their bed. Actually, I know more about that than you care to know. In fact, the greatest thing that happened to me this year is that I was invited to join the board of the Harvard School of Medicine Sleep Division. Because I've been talking about it so much, they think I'm a real evangelist for their cause. But the point is that there is real medical evidence that you cannot have a truly recharging sleep if your devices are charging beside you. You wake up in the middle of the night. How many of you here are tempted to look at your data if you wake up in the middle of the night? Be honest. You see, not good. They say even if you go back to sleep, it's not as recharging and deep as we need it. And how many people cannot go to sleep anymore without a sleeping pill? Not occasionally, but every night.
Don't ask that question.
But you know, my point is that we need to learn to deal with the growing stresses of our lives, which is why we are actually paradoxically, this is a paradox, and we talked about that earlier, but paradoxically, we've developed an app which is using technology to disconnect us from technology. We are calling it a GPS for the soul. We are bringing it out in 2 months. It will bring you, you'll be able to download it on any smartphone. It has a stress sensor. It will give you your heart rate variability. And then you'll be able to program the app with the things that help you course correct, that help you reduce your stress. A particular kind of music, pictures of your children when they were young and unproblematic.
Breathing. You got a hit on your hands, let me tell you.
Breathing exercise, meditation techniques, whatever it is, you can tell the app, I have 2 minutes, I have 5 minutes, I have 10 minutes.
So is your app going to tell me to turn off my other apps?
Your app. That's the point. You will tell, when you're in a centered, wise place, you will tell your app what is going to help you. And then when you are stressed and out of balance, it will feed it back to you. Plus, we're going to have an entire section, which we've already launched, called the GPS for the Soul section, with a whole smorgasbord of things for you to choose from. My whole point is that young people who are used to apps are going to go to that, and it will begin to help the process of identifying stress and learning how to de-stress at any age. But I'm particularly interested in young people, both because I have two of them in my family, And also because I think it's so key, since they've grown up with the internet, to learn to disconnect.
Larry, you're going to do this GPS.
Well, my fear is that this app is also going to be programmed to call my wife to tell me that I'm stressed, so she can yell at me for being too stressed.
Being too stressed. Let me change the subject now a little bit. That's not why.
Can we just check one other thing? I mean, this sounds very Buddhist to me. It makes me think of Robin Williams when he goes to New York to buy a hot dog and he says, make me one with everything. Okay, sorry.
I'm not going to invoke Robin Williams here. I mean, an app with Robin Williams would not de-stress anybody. Let's dive into some particulars of this thing we call the internet and how it's transforming what we see, learn, how we participate. Let's start with politics. It is said that Barack Obama arguably would not be President of the United States without the internet, that he was able to mobilize so many people to do so much in his first run for office, to give them their money and their time and their commitment. Has this changed our politics?
I think it is true, first of all, that Barack Obama would not be president were it not for the internet. I think there's no question that he galvanized young people and used the internet to organize around it in a way that was unprecedented. Chris Hughes, who was one of the early Facebook founders who ran Obama's internet campaign, was masterful at that. I remember going to Chicago to meet with him during the election, and we had arranged to meet for breakfast in a hotel, and I arrived there, and I looked around, and I waited for 20 minutes because I did not believe that kid, literally, sitting at the table was actually Chris Hughes running the most revolutionary internet campaign. Finally, I thought, okay, that has to be Chris Hughes. But that was something which inspired an entire generation. He won't be able to do it now.
He
won't be able to repeat it. Because, first of all, he made the terrible mistake of abandoning them. You know, he had these 13 million people young people, and he gave it to the DNC, that just basically used them as a fundraising tool. And the one thing you can't do online is to just basically treat people just in order to get somewhere else. You know, you have to have an authentic, engaged relationship. Otherwise, it doesn't work and you lose them.
Larry, you've covered politics and the internet for a long time. Has this means of communication changed the way people run for office and the way we're governed?
Sure. First of all, the gotcha. If you make any kind of mistake at any point in your life, except maybe possibly in the privacy of your home, it's going to be on YouTube. And it just has changed.
I don't think the privacy of your home has anything
probably,
to do with
probably
it.
Even
nothing
that. Is a... Probably even that. So we have this kind of gotcha world where you know, you're always on call and you're always accountable for everything you do. And I think that's the negative. I think on the positive side, the fact that there can be a dialogue, and when done right, as when Chris Hughes did that right in 2008, and as local politicians are doing every day around the country, when done right, you can actually have a conversation with the voters in your constituency, and you can build that community. We can go back to that common that we had during the founding of our country and during the early days of our democracy, and we still have in some small towns where people are actually involved in the campaign.
So you think this improves our democracy? It improves the capability to connect and to participate?
I think it improves it when you have a discussion, a back and forth discussion, when someone can blog and comment on that blog and there's actually thoughtful discussion. Unfortunately, it is just as often abused. We have trolls, we have people who will trash anything you say, we have people both on television and on the internet who care more about their ideology than the truth and than facts, so it can be misused. But I've also seen it being used very effectively. And smart politicians can benefit from it, but also politicians can use it destructively.
Vint, I don't hear people walking around on the sidewalk or elsewhere saying, you know, our politics have gotten so much better, and I think it's because of this internet thing. In fact, I don't hear anybody saying our politics have gotten better for any reason.
Yeah, I actually think that, first of all, the premise that the president wouldn't have been elected without the internet is sort of an interesting assertion, because if the internet hadn't been there, there's still a perfectly good possibility that he would have been elected anyway using other kinds of methods for campaigning. So I don't think we can come to a definite conclusion there. I'm not sure I would argue one way or the other. With regard to the net, look, it's a tool. And every tool has uses and abuses. And we're still learning, I think, what those various uses and abuses are and how to deal with them. So it's not going to make politics better or worse. It's simply yet another medium in which the debate can happen.
I know an earlier Panetta Institute lecture dealt with the presidency. How do you think, Arianna Huffington, the notion, the office, the execution of the presidency has been changed by this instant communication? President doesn't need to call a press conference anymore. He held a Google town hall meeting not long ago. Try to have a conversation directly with the American people, but are they really listening? Are they participating?
Well, I think one of the great things about the internet is that it recognizes inauthentic communication.
Inauthentic.
Yes, and it kind of responds to authentic communication. So it's not as easy to just manipulate communications. And after all, political communication is almost always, with the few rare exceptions that we all treasure in our history, manipulated. You know, there is always some other reason why they want to talk to you. You know, they want your money, they want your vote, they want to pretend they care. Whatever is going on, it's not exactly authentic communication most of the time. You know, there are these great rare moments when it happens, but. When it's not authentic, it's not really going to work online in the same way. I mean, it's going to work in a way that 30-second ads work, but it's not going to create this incredible movement that we saw in 08.
Well, I think we also need to distinguish between the public pronouncements of the candidates, whether on the internet or on television, and they're pretty much the same. I mean, at that point, the internet is just an extension of television. And the private communications of people, for example, on Twitter and Facebook between each other. So I have Facebook friends who express their political opinions. A bit of an echo chamber because my friends tend to have some of the same attitudes that I have, and there's a little bit of a problem there. But nevertheless, there is sort of a vibrant debate that goes on among people who I'm I'm part of this community with, and there are people all over the world. And the same thing is true on Twitter. And the candidates don't manipulate that. They may try, but at the end of the day, they don't have any control over what people tweet and put on Facebook.
One of the most interesting things that the research shows that is that has the most impact on you, the voter, on you, the consumer, is where your information comes from, if it's a trusted source,
right,
a credible source. So if it's a friend texting you, tweeting you, Facebooking, and saying, check out what so-and-so has said, or I like this, mm-hmm, that has a different impact. That's a big change.
So I don't know whether the rest of the people in the audience or the folks here on the stage have the same experience I do, but I'm finding myself drawn to pay attention to things that other people point me at. I get emails saying, please read this, or go have a look at that. So I think that that particular effect is important, because there are things that happen in the world that get the attention of policymaking people faster because they pop up off the internet. The YouTube videos have had a very powerful impact on decision-making and policymaking and recognition and awareness of events in the world. So I think that that's different. This two-way ability to communicate, this horizontal communication as opposed to purely hierarchical, and the fact that you can react. I mean, when I read things in, let's say, the New York Times online, you get an op-ed or a column of some sort, and then you get commentary. Some of it's crazy, the trolls show up. But an awful lot of this is thought-provoking, and it's stuff that you would not normally ever have seen, because it would never have made it through the letters to the editor structure.
And it's amazing how your voice can be amplified. So I was on a plane recently, and the airline made the mistake of having Wi-Fi. And the reason they made the mistake of having Wi-Fi is I had been mistreated, in my opinion, at the airport. And something happened that I wasn't happy with. So I tweeted it. I'll be honest, it was Delta. And somebody tweeted back, he said, you should say pound Delta. So I tweeted it again, this time it was pound Delta. By the time the plane landed in San Francisco, they had a guy in a red coat there to take care of me, offer me a free limo ride home. Anything, you know, $50 certificate. Now, admittedly, I probably have more Twitter followers than the average person. That might have had somewhat of a consideration. But the fact that it was retweeted and amplified, probably tens of thousands of people were party, and Delta wasn't about to leave me
unhappy. I think the takeaway here is don't make Larry angry.
Not on a Wi-Fi connected airplane.
Be very nice to him. That's very interesting, you know, because that suggests that someone was following you at Delta or something.
Well, they were following the pound Delta. Even if I was an unknown person, it still would have gotten their attention.
No, this is actually a very, very important change in what brands are doing. They are now recognizing that they can no longer just hide behind a glossy ad, mm-hmm, and disappear, because they need to engage. They need to enter the arena, and that's why online advertising is growing, and it's going to continue growing, because they have to enter that conversation. And I remember the first time we had what we call sponsor-generated blogs, you know, that are paid by brands. The first one that was a big hotel chain. And our comments are all pre-moderated. From day one, we pre-moderate our comments.
Pre-moderating means what? Explain that.
It means that no comment can appear unless it has been through either our algorithm that checks for words, etc., or human moderators. The reason for that is that we wanted to maintain a civil environment, not to have a conversation that's taken over by trolls, by ad hominem attacks, and it has really paid off.
Do you have any idea how many comments
well,
have been posted?
Well, we've had, since the beginning, the Huffington Post is now 7 years old, we've had over 150 million comments.
150 million
yes.
comments.
So it's really very easy to get a story or a blog that gets thousands of comments. And these are all comments that many of which you would want to read. You know, you may disagree or not agree, but basically they're interesting comments. So my point here is that the first comment of this sponsor-generated blog by this hotel company was a negative one. It was like an example of how they had been mistreated at the hotel, et cetera, et cetera. The head of marketing went berserk. Like, they wanted to withdraw the campaign. They thought this was terrible. Our advertising people said to them, stay in the arena. You know, even if you remove your marketing campaign, they're going to go to Facebook and Twitter. They're going to and you won't be there to respond. So they stayed in, they responded. The person, the client, turned out to be accurate. They others came in and wrote about positive experiences. Bottom line is that it was an entirely positive experience because they had engaged. And this is really what's happening now. You can no longer withdraw. It's better to stay there and have a conversation.
Yeah. No, you. I think one of the big changes here is you are on the line 24/7,
right?
Because the whole world
no,
is participating.
No, 8 hours sleep.
Okay. I want to come back to the one of the snakes in the Garden of Eden, I guess it is, Ariana, that you talked about, and thinking about politics and thinking about how this has changed our lives. Imagine what life would have been like if, in the middle of the Constitutional Convention in this country, Alexander Hamilton, John Jay, Madison, they're working on the Federalist Papers, and you know, Thomas Jefferson is sitting in the back of the room tweeting or something. I mean, seriously, this was an incredible exercise. Yeah. I went back, I thought about this. I thought, what about John and Abigail Adams? These incredible letters they wrote to one another, and they lived through history. They weren't just something. On March 31st, 1776, Abigail Adams wrote, "Remember, all men would be," to her husband, "all men would be tyrants if they could. If particular care and attention is not paid to the ladies, we are determined to foment a rebellion and will not hold ourselves bound by any laws in which we have no voice or representation." That's more than 140 characters.
Yeah.
Right. No problem. She could have put it on her Facebook or on Google+, or both, and then had a shorter version on Twitter.
But seriously, if we think about the kind of communication we have had through the ages that is enshrined and that is held up forever. If you've been to this Folger Library and seen Shakespeare's original works, we worry about communication that is so temporal, gone.
There would have been far more than 85 or so Federalist Papers or whatever the relatively small number is, and of course they would have been a lot, they would have been a lot shorter, I suppose. But it would have been a much broader conversation, and it would, theoretically at least, have been a conversation that didn't just include the elite, that the average person in the colonies at the time would have at least had an opportunity to weigh in. I don't know what would have happened. You know, we might still be sipping tea and worshiping the sovereign. I'm not sure. But the bottom line is that that whole period most of American history, and really today still, primarily the elite are the ones that are part of the conversation. So that's, the big question is, how can we change that power structure so that the average person truly is part of the conversation?
Let's look at news and information. Newspaper ad revenue is down in 2011 more than 10%. The New Orleans Times-Picayune just recently announced that it's not going to publish 5 days a week, only 3 days a week. The rest, find it online. You have an army of bloggers whom you do not pay. Do we worry about credible, careful, checked information becoming yet another endangered species in this revolution?
I think it's not at all. I'm very sad about the Times-Picayune paper. I think it's an amazing paper. And as David Carr wrote in the New York Times today, it was sort of part of the culture of the city. Sitting around reading your paper. So that's sad. I mean, I think there are casualties of the new technologies. But journalism is not a casualty.
Journalism is not
a
casualty.
No, absolutely not. I think that as ProPublica winning a Pulitzer, the Huffington Post winning a Pulitzer, has demonstrated that great journalism can be practiced anywhere. We now have 500... reporters, editors, journalists that we pay full-time salaries, and we are a platform. You see, I think this is what we need to understand. We are two things, and I think more and more media operations are going to be two things: a journalistic enterprise that honors the best traditions of journalism, and a platform that provides distribution to tens of thousands of people who otherwise would not have had a voice. They can write or not write. They can take advantage of it or not take advantage of it. But many of them take advantage because it helps amplify their voices. It's also an audition platform. It's just amazing how many of our young bloggers who can be side by side with Larry or well-known people get paid attention to, and they get book contracts and they find jobs, and it's like a way now to become known.
Are you as optimistic and bullish?
Well, I think the Huffington Post is a great global platform, but I worry about local journalism. It bothers me that the Times-Picayune is having troubles, and the reason it bothers me is not whether they publish three times a week or five times a week, but it's those local reporters that are at City Hall that don't get the economies of scale on the national or international level. I don't know who's going to pay for that. We still have local television and radio, and it has its limitations, but I can tell you, I know that local television and radio has traditionally leaned on the local newspaper, and I worry about the local newspaper. Somebody has to pay these people. It's not the printing press that costs money. It's the time and talent, and there has to be some way to do it, and I'm not sure what's going to take its place.
Well, actually, I think that local journalism is incredibly important. You know, one of the great things that AOL is part of AOL is Patch,
which
is a hyper-local initiative where you have local journalists, where you have the community involved in what is happening.
But Ariana, in newspaper after newspaper, in city after city, community after community, reporters' jobs have been cut, editors' jobs have been cut, circulation is way down, and it's a question of who's going to report that the lettuce at the supermarket is bad or the mayor is making off with your tax dollars.
This is not a surprise in some sense. This is economics. And what's happened, at least in part, is that the economics of paper are very different from the economics of digital. And so the thing which made newspapers so attractive is it was the cheapest way to get a large amount of information out to a large number of people on a regular periodic basis. Everybody wanted to know what was new. And because they wanted to know what was new, they subscribed to the newspaper. But that also meant that advertisers could be persuaded to pay for ads because they knew people would see them along with the articles
right.
they were reading. It was a nice combination. The economics worked out well. It was a very powerful enterprise. Along comes this online environment. Suddenly, more people have the ability to speak, and it's faster. You don't have to wait for the paper to be printed. The article goes out as soon as the editor says it's ready to go out, assuming you still have an editor.
Yeah, assuming. Big assumption, by the way.
but the thing is, on top of all that, the ads in the newspapers were fixed. The ads in the online environment can dynamically change depending on who is reading it and when they're reading it. So this is a very different model. We've succeeded very well at Google, and others have done well with advertising. The key question in my mind is whether or not we can find business models that will support high-quality journalism, which I think is essential to a
democracy. Can you find those business models? Are you making more money, enough money, with the advertising to hire the investigative journalist who can spend 3 or 6 months on a project, to hire the journalist or others who are going to travel around the world to tell us what's happening there?
First of all, there are going to be many different models. In our case, David Wood, who won the Pulitzer for Beyond the Battlefield, spent 8 months traveling around writing about returning vets and the lives they were facing when they got back home. And it was on video, and it was with great photography, and it invited our readers, those who had vets in their lives, in their communities, to write about it as well, which is, again, what is so unique about the internet. The fact that the conversation and the story does not end with the reporter filing.
Right.
It continues with the people who are reading it, who are adding to the story. And also, every story had a list of things that people could do to help the vets. So it doesn't just end with people saying, oh, how terrible, how sorry we should all be. It also provides us an outlet for actually doing something about it, making a difference.
I was very pleased and proud to see that Huffington Post won a Pulitzer. I remember years ago when USA Today first started publishing, the joke at the time was, you know, USA Today was all these short bits, which is how they started, that they'd win a Pulitzer someday for the best investigative paragraph. and that Huffington Post might one day win a Pulitzer for the best investigative sentence. But it was much more than that. It was real journalism.
Yeah.
Right?
It is a 10-part series that is ongoing. That's
series.
The other thing. Yeah. He has filed more stories since then because, again, that is what is unique about the internet. That, in a sense, if you think of traditional journalism, mainstream media, they often suffer from ADD, attention deficit disorder. You know, they may break a big story on the front page and then they move on and abandon that story. Now, we online suffer from OCD. We suffer from obsessive compulsive disorder. You know, we take a story and we stay on it, and we stay on it, and we develop it, and we invite our readers to add to it, and we put video on, and we have photography, etc., etc., because a story is ongoing. The big stories of our time, you know, unemployment, returning vets, foreclosures, you know, all the big
The question, though, and then I want to move on to something else. Last one on this one. The question, though, is we talked about the revolution here. And the revolution really is that in the old days, the news came to you. Mm-hmm. The paper came to you.
Yes.
There were the gatekeepers who said, you need to know this one, this one, this one, and this one. That goes on the front page. Now you go to it.
Right. So,
but the question is, do you go to that which makes you uncomfortable, it's unfamiliar, or do you only go, or predominantly go, to your own partisan kind?
I think there are two issues here. One issue is that as 18 years as a syndicated newspaper columnist in print, with a very different model, I would write a column based on what I and my editor considered to be important, and I don't know whether it got 100,000 readers or 1 million readers or 20 readers, but we knew that we were doing something that we felt was important. Today, there is an incentive. And there are blogs, one of which I write for, Forbes.com, famously pays each journalist, each freelance journalist, by the click, by the view.
By the click.
By the view. So I have an incentive to get those eyeballs, not an incentive necessarily to write the most important stories in the world, but incentive to get the views. And so I actually fight that, but I'm aware of that incentive. But you're absolutely right. There is a big danger of people sort of doing what some people used to do in print. You open the paper to the sports section, or the business section, or the fashion section, and completely skip the front page. There's a reason why there are really important stories on the front page of the New York Times. Whether they're about sports, or fashion, or technology, somebody's making that decision. Online, it is very possible to skip right past that, and very easy to skip right past that, and to get an echo chamber, both in terms of the interest you have, I only care about business, or the politics you care, I only care about Democrats, I only care about Republicans, and completely ignore the larger discussion. And that does worry me.
Vint, into our digital Garden of Eden, there is another snake, a snake that we haven't talked about, and this we'll call it the cybersecurity snake. The snake that could disrupt all of our, or a lot of our commerce, that can open floodgates on a dam, that could disrupt electricity. How much do you worry about that?
A lot. I spend a lot of time working on that.
How vulnerable are we?
I'm sorry?
How vulnerable are we?
We're probably less vulnerable than many people say, but we are more vulnerable than we should be. There are things that are happening right now to deal with that problem. There are a bunch of technical things that we can do or are doing to build a much more resilient and system resistant to some of the kinds of attacks that can be made, and I'm very pleased about that. We also have to pay attention to the fact that the things that you and I do create vulnerability. We put information up on the net that we probably shouldn't put up. People use that for identity theft, create accounts, steal money from the banks, etc. Or they get into your own account and they do bad things. That's partly our fault. We use passwords that are too easy to guess. Believe it or not, there are some people who use the word password for their password because it's easy to remember, right?
Any names you want to share with us here this evening?
Sorry, I'm not going to give you any of mine. But so there are techniques called one-time passwords. These are generated cryptographically for you. You have a little gadget or you have a little piece of software in your mobile that generates these things. So even if somebody sees it, they can't reuse it. There are things like that and other things that can make the system a lot more resilient. And that is a process that's ongoing.
What do you worry about most in this?
I think I worry the most right now about viruses, worms, and Trojan horses that we ingest into our computers through our browsers. Because when you go to a web page, what happens is that you are downloading a file,
right,
which is going to be interpreted by the browser. And when the World Wide Web was first created, the only thing that you were downloading was text, imagery, and some layout.
Right.
So it was kind of like pulling a magazine page in. But in 2013, in addition to that, you're downloading programs that are going to be executed on your machine through the browser, whether they're written in Java or JavaScript or Python or something else. And the problem is some of those are what we call malware. Those are programs that, when executed by the browser, store Trojan horses and things in the operating system.
And what can this do to us?
Well,
what's the consequence?
Once your machine is compromised, it becomes what's called a zombie.
Right.
And there's a botnet herder who now has control over the machine. This is kind of like leaving your car in the driveway with the keys in it. You don't know that your machine has been infected. It doesn't behave any differently as far as you're concerned, but someone can use that machine to launch denial of service attacks, to generate spam, and install a keylogger to watch to see what bank accounts you're using. Those are the things that we need to defend against the most.
Ariana, what do you worry about on this?
This was all Greek to me. I'm very glad that Curtis Brown, the AOL CTO, is in the audience. You have to explain it all to me, Curtis, tomorrow. How many people understood what the very, very brilliant gentleman here said?
Look at that.
That's a pretty good. That's about half.
I could do it. The bottom line is you go online thinking perfectly innocently about this page you're going to download. Bad stuff comes into your computer. You lose control of your computer. Somebody else can do something there.
Yeah. Well, so Google is trying to deal with that, too, because when we do an index of the World Wide Web,
I have to not lose control here,
yeah,
which is not easy, because it's time to start taking some of the audience's questions.